Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Soul Seekers podcast, where we believe that hunting has the power to transform lives through primal adventure as we share our mission of mentorship is conservation. To learn more about everything we do, check out our show on Carbon TV or go to soulseekersnation.com. Freedom on, everybody, and stay soulful. If you want to take your shooting experience to the next level, then check out Coltac gear for 100% made in America products. Coltac manufactures specialty gear designed for long-range shooting, hunting, and other tactical applications. From their support bags, suppressor covers, shooting mats, and a whole lot more, Coltac is creating tough, durable, and innovative gear for both civilian and professional markets. Go to Coltac.com to see all that they have to offer. That's Coltac.com. If you are looking to get a new rifle or build your own, look no further than Kelbley's. Kelbley's actions and rifles have a higher level of accuracy and hold 92 world records set on either one of their rifles or rifle actions. Whether you're looking for an ultralight mountain rifle or wanting to compete in precision rifle shooting, Kelbley's has you covered. Go to Kelbley.com to find out more or give them a call as their customer service is the best. That's Kelbley.com. Kelbley's. If you're looking to take your hunting to another level, there's no better way to do it than by subscribing to Onyx Hunt. If you want to get better at hunting and go deeper into your scouting, Onyx is the number one GPS app for that. Join the millions of hunters who trust Onyx Hunt to find more game, discover new access, and hunt smarter. If you want to know more about Onyx, go to onyxmaps.com/hunt or download their app today for a free trial. If you are wanting to become more accurate and deadly with your shooting, one of the best things you can do is upgrade your trigger with a Timney. Timney triggers are 100% made in America and have been since their founding, providing a crisp, reliable, and repeatable trigger break every time. I'll be shooting Timney triggers in my guns this year, and I hope you'll join me in shooting the world's finest trigger. Go to TimneyTriggers.com to get yours today. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Soul Seekers podcast. I'm your host, Johnny Mack, and today's episode is one that I've actually been wanting to bring to you for quite a few different years. I met this gentleman a few years back as I was diving into growing everything in regards to mentorship as conservation, and there is a platform based out of the state of Idaho that I ran into, and the fellow is Rick Brazel. He is the president and founder of First Hunt Foundation, and it is all about mentorship and guiding and guiding people in the right direction and for fulfillment and to get more people hunting, because not everyone needs to hunt, but everyone needs to respect hunting and needs to support hunting. That's one of the biggest things that happens, is that regardless of whether or not someone is a hunter for the rest of their lives, perspectives always outweigh opinions. And in order to get a perspective, you have to go through an experience. And when we have experiences, they're life transforming. And that's why we always talk about hunting has the power to transform lives through primal adventure. So without further ado, we're going to get into the episode today. If you guys are interested in learning more about the First Hunt Foundation, go check out their website at firsthuntfoundation.org. And follow up to this episode. I'd love to connect with you guys and talk more. But without further ado, Mr. Rick, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me on. Oh, I'm excited.
Yeah, it's a great
time. I'm a fellow Texan and you're in Texas, so it just makes me feel good.
Yes. I posted on my social media the other day, I go, proud to be American, blessed to be a Texan, you know? So I actually, I migrated downward and south. I'm from the state of Washington originally. So I grew up in Western Washington, and the idea of hunting in, from my perspective, not very welcoming environment to really dive into and grab hold of this thing that's so life transforming. One of the things, when I got into hunting and I shot one of my very first animals, I ended up, I'm a school teacher. I don't know if I shared that with you, but
yeah.
I brought a bunch of ground meat. We made tacos for the staff one day, and I was like, oh, I'll provide the meat. Well, turns out people didn't like the fact that it was elk meat, and then they barely even touched it. And that was one of the first moments in my hunting career where I was like, wow, people really like are turned off by anything that is beyond their comfort zone. And so that's a great segue into everything that you're doing over the First Hunt Foundation. But just real quick, kick off, what is First Hunt Foundation? How can people get involved, be supported? And we'll dive into that as we go.
Oh, you betcha. You betcha. Well, we're a mentoring organization, obviously. I mean, that's what we do. Our mission is to save the hunting heritage. So when us old guys tap out, you know, you young guys and more young guys are still going to be hunting 10 years from now. And it's part of the American culture. It doesn't go away. And by doing that, we got to get more hunters.
Yeah.
I mean, just there's a whole lot of people that don't hunt. There's a lot of people that are aging out of hunting. I mean, I hate to tell people my age, but I'm almost 72. And 2 weeks ago, I was up in four different trees, putting up tree stands,
awesome. You know,
free climbing. And we had some kids the other day. They were like 12 and 13. I said, now, you guys are just starting out. And I'm a pretty old guy. And I was up in four trees last week. And they're looking at me. I said, you got a lot of years left to have fun. And yeah. So, it's just fun teaching them. But that's our mission, is to save hunting. We have a women's program as well called Share the Heritage. It's all about getting girls and women into hunting. Mm-hmm. We've got a program called Connecting Heroes and Hunters, which is about our veterans and first responders, getting them into hunting, getting them to be mentors, getting a new mission in their life. We've got another program called Forgotten Rights, RITES, that's about underserved communities, people of color, because nationally, statistically, a lot of those folks don't get into hunting. So we try to look at when I started it with just something I wanted to do when I retired after 36 years with the U.S. Forest Service managing public land. And I was a wildlife biologist for years. And then I became a forest supervisor managing 4 million acres. I always wanted a ranch in Texas, but I couldn't afford one. So finally I worked my way up. So I got to manage like 4 million acres and make all the decisions, but I also got all the lawsuits and stuff like that. But anyway, I thought, well, what am I going to do? And I thought, well, I'm going to start this organization helping kids. It's all about kids. And other people in other states where I'd moved said, well, can I do it here? And I go, sure, yeah, we're federally listed as a nonprofit. So before you know it, we're in seven states. And I'm sitting there going, well, dang, maybe I ought to think bigger, because it was just something to do. And all of a sudden, we're in 17 states. And now we're in all 50 states. We have mentors in all 50 states that are operational. And it's just insane. I love it. I mean, we're feeling like we're starting to make a big difference. Mm-hmm. Our data shows in 24 that it's going to be something like 41,000 days of either teaching a hunting skill or taking somebody hunting. So that's, and the year before that was 22,000. So it's just jumping as we get more people, and people are signing up. It's free to sign up. There's no obligation. You sign up, we do a background check, because we can't have people out with kids that don't have background check.
Right.
And then basically I tell people, if you're already taking kids out and other people, just sign up with us. And then we have all kinds of, we have insurance, liability insurance, free. Our mission is to save hunting. We're not going to charge people to do that.
Right.
So that's what it's about. Just getting more people involved in hunting and teaching them the right things, the ethical things, and just having a good time and harvesting animals, food sustainability, all that stuff.
Yeah, man. It's so awesome. You get me fired up. I love seeing people inspired, because I always talk about on this podcast, inspired people inspire people, right?
Yeah.
When we are inspired ourselves, it's contagious, right? Just like when I smile at somebody, it's natural to smile back, right?
Right.
If I frown at somebody, a lot of times you'll get a frown back. So when we live inspired and we are letting our light shine before men, it just naturally, you know, bam, 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 catches and spreads like a wildfire. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
I just want to make one acknowledgement real quick, and it's really impressive that you were a wild, you are, I guess, still, maybe not practicing, wildlife biologist, and you are a hunter. Because in the state of Washington, where I came from, and I don't know what it's like across the nation, but a lot of times it seems like biologists aren't hunters.
Yeah, and there was a trend when I was in the government. We had a big annual meeting, had 150 wildlife biologists there. And they asked, the leader did, how many of you are hunters? And back then, this was years ago, only half the room raised their hands. And I'm sitting, I'm a fur fishing game biologist. You know, I did my master's thesis on, it was on habitat for deer, elk, and moose, sage grouse, rough grouse, a coyote. And anyway, I did a habitat plan for all those species on a national forest in Idaho, but it's all about critters that usually are consumptive.
Right. Right.
And, but a lot of the biologists are good people, but they don't know much about hunting. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. Yeah. It was really interesting. I found out, you know, the state of Washington and the Department of Fish and Wildlife over there has its own issues. If anyone's listening to this podcast and is not staying in tune with what's going on in the hunting world, the Department of Fish and Wildlife in Washington State is, it's a hot mess when it comes to their fishing game leadership council that is, you know, picked and chose by the governor. And there's a lot of stuff with that. But the point, what I was going to say is I had a lot of interactions with people that worked at the Fish and Game Department that are writing, I hate even using this word, writing biased articles because they're not even hunters and never even gone through hunter safety, but yet they work for the Fish and Game and are writing, you know, pro-wolf articles, persuasive articles that are published by a Fish and Game Department, and yet they don't really have that experience. And it's so important to be vocal, right? And it's so long we've been silent, it seems like. And you know, it's time to take a stand and you know, well, Abraham Lincoln said, stand for something or you'll fall for anything.
Right. Well, in our case, Washington is our highest number of mentors. We have over 400 mentors in the state of Washington.
I love that.
And a lot of those are our leaders over there, two chapter presidents worked for the Division of Wildlife. And so they're really pro hunting.
That's
and
awesome.
Very good at helping host events and all that. But they talk about some of the commission that you're talking about mm-hmm. that the governor have appointed aren't as supportive of hunting as they should be for managing the wildlife commission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Yeah. It's quite interesting, but with all that, it's really going back to you being a hunter and a biologist, man, that's a special thing, right? That shows that you are actually invested in to the future of it, right? You're understanding and you hold a lot of knowledge that the average human being might not really ever encounter. So where did your passion for the outdoors come from?
You know, I think it's genetic. I honestly do. Because my dad wasn't a big hunter. I can remember two or three times in my life, him going hunting with my uncles. And I remember crying. I was probably 5 years, 6 years old. They wouldn't take me. And I just wanted to go so bad, you know.
Yeah.
But my dad had a few guns. And so my buddy and I, at about the eighth grade in Texas, we started learning how to hunt. And we'd ask anybody that would tell us anything about it. And we learned on our own. My dad he'd get mad at me because I was supposed to be mowing the yard and I'd be off hunting. I'd get the .22 and go down chasing bullfrogs or snakes or something in Texas. And he'd say, boy, you were raised 100 years too late. You should have been born during the mountain man days. All you want to do is be in the woods. And so I always wanted to be out in nature. I don't know why. It just drove me. I wanted to be a biologist from the time I was probably, you know, 15 or 16. I knew I wanted to work outdoors, and I fulfilled that goal of becoming a wildlife biologist and worked 36 years with the U.S. Forest Service and then retired and wanted to give something back because I have a good retirement. Nobody in our organization gets paid. We're the largest mentoring organization in the nation, and no one gets paid. We're all volunteers.
Yeah.
And I got some top-notch people that are volunteering their time. I mean, top-notch people.
That is awesome. Is your program set up for adults?
Yes. Yeah. We've taken several 70-year-old people out and shot their first elk, women, actually. We take anybody that wants to learn about hunting, anybody. It started with kids, and about R3 movement. Well, as we started in that 10 years ago and started going to the meetings, and I started seeing that, hey, if we're going to save hunting, it's got to be more than kids.
Right.
The problem with kids is that you can take them and they may love it, but if their parents don't support them, they're not going to buy them their bow or the gun and all that. You take an adult and they love it, they're going to take their discretionary money and go get that stuff and actually become a hunter quicker than the kid. But that doesn't mean we're ignoring the kids, but that's just the reality. A lot of kids want to do it, but their parents are like, well, I'll let you try it. But
Yeah. With the kids, you're planting a seed, right? You're planting a seed for the future that you hope blossoms, takes root, and grows into something more. When you hook an adult, you impact legislation immediately because they are of voting rights. They are of the age to buy firearms and to instantly impact the Pittman-Robertson Act and all that going back into conservation and all that. So yeah, extremely. I am one of those. And it's one of the interesting things is I'm now, when I got into hunting and I became a hunter, I had one child who was a year old. Like I started my hunting journey as I was having children. And now I have three boys that are being raised in the lineage of hunting.
Yeah.
And one of the things I like to say is regardless of whether or not my children ever choose to be hunters, they are always going to be pro hunting because of the foundation in which I am establishing with them.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, they're going to be in the office talking to their folks that they work with every day, whether they hunt or not, and going, oh, my family hunted. I ate deer meat growing up. It's great. No problem.
Yeah. How did you go about creating the First Hunt Foundation?
Well, I knew I wanted to start a nonprofit, and I just researched it. I had a friend, Mike Christensen, who with Outdoor Mentors passed it on. He and I are really tight. And the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, who I'd worked with professionally as a biologist, I talked to them about trying to get a grant and get started and all that. And they actually, if it wasn't for them, we wouldn't be where we're at today. Mm-hmm. Because for about 5 years, they give us nearly $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
And we got to go all over the nation to outdoor shows and get stuff. And I mean, I owe a lot of our success to the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. They were just awesome. But anyway, I got with Mike and I formed a chapter under Outdoor Mentors Pass It On. And so we were actually a chapter under them. And then we, again, like I said, I started growing in other states because they were only in Kansas at that time. And before you know it, the insurance people that they had for liability insurance said, wait a minute, you guys are different because you're in like 17 states. I said, no, we're doing the same thing as them. We're just, you know, no. So they said, we won't give you insurance anymore. So we basically had to get away from them and start our own insurance policy and take off on our own. So,
yeah. Yeah. Mike is
on our own anyway, but
Mike's an awesome guy. I actually, I interviewed for the job this past June with him, and Brittany has been on her podcast before, and she's a phenomenal human being and just all around amazing things. And I love seeing people literally pass it on. I mean, it's in the name of what they have going on, but the whole point, I always say you can never outgive good, right? Like our job as humans, I believe that we're made in the image of God. We're made in his creation. We're co-creators with him. And through that, he says, love God and love man. Well, there's no better way to love man than to provide your time with somebody. And time can be physically with them or verbally and spending a time on a phone call or a video chat like what we're doing. Or, you know, and it's just about giving, right? And when you give, you're never going to be able to outgive it because the good just naturally is in the world, and what goes around comes around, and not that we do it for the end result, but we do out of the love of our own heart, and it's a beautiful thing.
Yep.
So you are in First Hunt Foundation is what, 10 years old, you said?
It's 10 years ago. It started in April 2015.
That is awesome. So is there like a graduation program that you can grow with it if you get in as a child or a kid? Or what type of carryover or continuation do you have with people that sign up to be mentees within your program?
That it varies across the nation, of course, and it varies according to the mentor. I can use myself as an example. I've taken two or three young people that are currently mentors now that started off as mentees, and they wanted to learn everything. So I take them duck hunting. I take them predator hunting. I take them elk hunting. I take them deer hunting. I taught them. They're like sponges.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of that goes on because I talk to a lot of the mentors everywhere. we don't have a formal program like, hey, check this box, check this box. Because there's a kind of a debate of when do you become a hunter? And I can tell you that a game warden will, if you have a hunting license and you've never hunted a day in your life and you step out in the woods,
you're a hunter.
Game warden, you're a hunter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how much training you've had, the hunter state hunter ed, but that might have been not even shooting a gun.
Mm-hmm.
And so in some states, so we don't really have a program to track that because we're so big and so diverse as far as all over all the states and different skill levels. Some mentors may only teach muzzleloader. Some may teach, like I did everything because I've hunted with everything. Others might only teach archery. And then some might be just rifle hunting. I mean, and then, like I say, everybody's different. Mm-hmm. So we don't really have any set programs that you got to check this box and that box and that box to get some level of proficiency. Doesn't mean we won't have that someday, but we've been growing so fast. It's just our big issue is finding leaders. I mean, we're in all 50 states, but I've only got state directors in like 9 states. And so so the mentors and that don't have state directors are going to be mentors and they're going to keep doing what they're doing. And we're going to support them with insurance. And we got all kinds of perks that we're because industry gives us discounts and that sort of thing. But when we can get a state director to volunteer or a chapter president, then they can use our nonprofit status. They have the authority to represent First Hunt, to knock on doors, to get donations, to go see ranchers, do all the stuff that a leader would do and get a program going versus the one-on-one mentoring that's happening all over the nation.
Right.
I mean, so you got events. I mean, you got one-on-one mentoring, and then where you got chapters and stuff, you've got events. You got state directors. You may have multiple events in one state, and they can raise money like with raffles, banquets, whatever. And all the money they raise stays in that state, except for banquets. It's like 70% of it stays in the state because
yeah.
we pay all the liability insurance and hats and all that sort of thing. But once you're a leader, you can do lots of other stuff. But other than that, you just be a mentor and keep having fun taking people out.
That's cool. I like that. I like that. What are some helpful hints for somebody who's listening to this podcast and they, you know, they bought into my mentorship as conservation mission and they want to be a part of making sure hunting lasts for generations to come?
Yeah.
What are some of the best helpful hints or tips that you can provide to somebody who's listening to this podcast to be a mentor and to walk people through that journey?
Well, have I got something I can give you? We got a grant 2 years ago from the National Rifle Association. Actually, it's from the National Rifle Association Foundation, NRA Foundation. And like 120,000, and we developed a state-of-the-art training program for mentors. It's an online course called the ABCs of Outdoor Mentoring, and it's free. And we had 19 state agencies help us figure out the things that what does a mentor need, what are important things. We worked very close with the National Mentoring Resource Center, which a lot of people don't even know exists. They've been around forever. They are the primo organization for mentoring, and not necessarily outdoor mentoring, but just mentoring. I mean, they got PhD people working for them that are constantly doing stuff. And we get technical assistance grant from them to help do that course, as well as a professional agency. So ABCs of Outdoor Mentoring, I'd say go take that course, hour and 15 minutes long. You will learn a ton of stuff. It has a ton of stuff you can print off on safety, liability, just all kinds of stuff. That's a great start.
Where is that found at?
It's you could just Google ABCs of Outdoor Mentoring. Our website has it as a link. Our website lately has been having some issues, and we're working on that. It went down for a while, and we're trying to figure out why. We're getting that solved, but it's on our website, or you can just Google ABCs of Outdoor Mentoring and probably it takes you to a site. It's on the NRA site. You just sign up and off you go to the races, man.
Yep. There you go. NRA and First Hunt Foundation, new free ABCs of Outdoor Mentorship course. I love that.
Yeah. It took us about a year, and it's like I say, the state of the science of outdoor mentoring. It's not just a bunch of old guy's ideas on how to do it.
Yeah. Act relational, be intentional, create community, develop enthusiasm.
Yes. Yeah.
Love that.
There you go.
Love that. Well, as a school teacher and someone who has spent a lot of time teaching, right? Like teaching is mentoring, sometimes without the relationship aspect, right? Like there's times where you just have to deliver information and have somebody pick it up. But one thing I know when it comes from teaching is that if you want your students to be masters, the best way to show mastery is to reteach, yeah. Right? So I teach a kid how to, let's say when I was a PE teacher, shoot a basketball, right? Bend my knees, elbow in, extend up, follow through. Okay. Beef. Got our beef program going on. So I got them. Okay. Can you do it? Yes. Maybe you can't do it the best, but what's the best way that you can maintain that memory of what you're doing? Go reteach it to somebody else. And that's one of the things is what I love about the mentoring aspect within hunting is you want to be a better hunter, go teach somebody how to hunt.
Yeah.
Right? Like you're going to be held accountable and held to the fire on what you do and how you do it and what you know simply because now you're having to go through that process in your brain, speak it out, and it becomes real rather than just being like, I think this is okay. Right? Like, I think I'm all right.
Yeah.
Did you ever have any formal training or what were some of the pitfalls that you came across when it came to mentoring some of the first people you ever took out hunting?
No, I didn't have formal training except for my mentors that we found growing up. As a professional in the Forest Service, I went to literally, when you added up months of leadership training, mm-hmm. you know, conflict management training, you just about name any course for management. So it helped teach me a lot about dealing with people and teaching people. And I was in front of lots of crowds. I mean, hundreds of people quite often talking about things that were happening in the forest, what we were planning on doing, how we were going to do it, forest planning, working with diverse groups. So I had a lot of experience in just teaching and talking, mm-hmm. and that helped me a lot too. So, and I'm still working on that. We all are. So,
yeah. What are the things that people struggle with the most when it comes to learning how to hunt?
So now say that again. I want to make sure I understand what you're saying.
What are the things that people feel like they struggle with the most, or they feel the most lack of confidence
right.
when it comes to learning how to hunt?
I think for a lot of them, it's the shooting. I mean, a lot of them are just getting into hunting and they're learning to shoot a gun or a bow, and they don't have confidence in it yet. They're good at putting holes in paper, and then they're going out there trying to not wound an animal. They're scared of hurting an animal. Some of them are scared of killing an animal for the first time. I've had people that wouldn't pull the trigger forever, and I couldn't figure out why. And finally, it was a young boy, and for 45 minutes, he had that buck broadside out there feeding. We were in a pop-up blind, and finally I said, okay, I know you can shoot him. What's going on? He looked at me and he says, I've never killed an animal. Mm. And it hit me like it wasn't about his fear of shooting or missing. It was something more deeper.
Yeah.
And I basically, you know, I know you're religious. He and I were, and I said, well, our Heavenly Father gives us these animals and there's plenty of them. And he knows that harvesting them, that you're not killing it just to kill it, that you're going to take it home to your family. Your family's going to be better off for having, because they literally were on welfare almost. Mm-hmm. In fact, when the grandmother raising the three boys by herself got the meat, she cried because she'd have all that meat. And so it was just, the whole thing came together. And once I told him that and he says, okay, it's okay. I can see now it's okay to kill this animal. And he did. And then what was sort of funny, we were walking out to the animal about 140 yards off. And I looked over at him and he says, man, I smoked him. I looked at him like, for 45 minutes, you wouldn't pull the trigger. and now he's being like a kid again. Man, I smoked him. I'm like, yeah, you did.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's awesome. I actually had that experience this last Friday. I took my middle son out for his very first time, and he shot his first deer. And he struggled with wanting to kill the deer.
Yeah.
And I told him, you know, beforehand, you know, we talked about, you know, animals, and animals provide food, and, you know, we try not to buy store-bought meat. We like to get our own meat, and he's a meat eater. He's a big time meat eater. You know, he'll say his favorite food is steak, and I'm like, yeah, great. Let's go get some. Let's go get the freshest steak possible that we can. But he was hunting does, and 120 yards out, and this doe comes, and we got a shot, and I'm like, he's like, I don't know, Dad. It's too cute. I don't want to kill it. I don't, you know, he really connects emotionally with animals and the tenderness of my boy's heart and really the innocence of a child, right? Like it's not just my child, or it's the innocence of human being. Like, to take a life is a
big thing.
It's a tipping point in your life on this earth. Is like, wow, I'm now a participant in nature, not just an observer of nature.
Yeah.
And once you cross that threshold, you can't go back. Right. And so before the hunt, you know, we prayed, we asked God to, you know, provide an opportunity for us to fill his tag, and asked God to provide an animal that was willing to sacrifice itself for the hunt as well. There's a lot of things in Native American culture, which I don't know how familiar you are with some of this, but a lot of Native Americans, when it came to hunting, they would take the first animal that presented itself, because it was a presentation of, I'm the one that's sacrificing myself for you so that you can live. And I always look at that as like, that's a beautiful thing, especially for newer hunters, to, if they can wrap their head around that and be like, okay, I can do this. It's all right. It's all right. How many conversations do you have with anti-hunters?
I really, you know, it's been interesting since I started the foundation. I figured I'd be getting lots of stuff, and maybe I will from your podcast. I don't know who follows it, but right. I did. There's nobody that's really challenged us or debated us or anything. I'm kind of surprised about that. I did deal with anti-hunters when I worked for the government. I had 23,000 emails once from anti-people that didn't want wolves being killed. And I had nothing to do with it. The Forest Service had nothing to do with it, but it was on Forest Service land. So they thought, since I was a Forest Soup, that I must have sanctioned it. Mm-hmm. I had 23,000 emails. And then another time I had 6,000 emails and 200 and something calls and death threats from some of my employees, and the FBI got involved. So I've seen that side of the crazies that are like, don't touch or kill anything.
Yep.
But I haven't dealt with it through the foundation. You know, I'm going to knock on some wood there. So.
Right. When it comes to the non-hunter, obviously you typically get people that want to experience hunting.
But some of our people are just curious, believe it or not. Some of the kids, the parents are kind of pushing them a little bit. And we'll have a camp, and there'll be 10 kids there, and they'll usually always be one or two, like, well, my mom and dad made me come. And I'm sitting, that's the flag immediately, like, okay, we got to take some special care with this kid. We can't just assume that they're here because a lot of them are just, like you say, excited. They're getting to go hunting.
Yeah.
But they're there, and they're willing to try it. And what happens so far, about 100% of the time, after a day or two with them, and they leave there and they've harvested and went through all the process and all that sort of thing at the camps, not the individual mentoring, they'll leave there going, wow. And they see the other kids. And when they see the other kids excited and doing it, like, I'm part of this cohort now of people that are bringing food to the family. And I tell them, I said, you know, this winter, when you're sitting at the dinner table and you're eating the steak on this, you look at your parents and you go, I put that on the table.
You betcha.
You feel proud because you did.
Yeah.
you fed the family with your efforts. And they grin, you know, like, yeah, I did. I fed my family. Mm-hmm. Dad usually does it or mom does it, but I did it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a powerful thing when you take ownership of your own life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And to be able to teach the youth or really anyone at any age who doesn't view life like that. I currently work in a discipline campus here in the state of Texas, and 70% of the students that end up in a campus like what I teach at end up in prison. So I work with a lot of victim mentality, right? It's not my fault. I'm innocent. I can't do it. I'm no good. You're the problem. It's not me. And the issue with that is a lot of people, they don't take ownership, right? They don't take ownership of their actions. They don't take ownership of how they speak, how they treat other people, how they show up in this world. And one of the coolest things that I feel like hunting does is it instantly thrusts you into this, you have to take ownership.
Yeah.
And that you don't get in life in many different avenues until you become older, right? The only thing I could truly compare it to is when my first son was born. And before, it was just my wife and I, and we just lived life exactly how we did previously, all we knew. And all of a sudden I was like, well, crap, I have to take care of something now. Like, I am responsible for something.
Yeah.
And hunting is like parallel to that, right? Like, I am responsible for the giving of life and I'm responsible for the taking of life now.
Yeah.
And that is such a powerful thing to really wrap your head around.
We get quite a few, and I don't mean this disrespectful in gender or anything, but we get a lot of single moms that call in and say, my son or my daughter wants to learn how to hunt. I don't have a clue. Mm-hmm. And some of them will say, my husband hunts, but he's not in the picture anymore. They had divorces or whatever. And so we have to fill a little bit of that role, at least for a short time, at least while you're in the woods, of teaching those principles of respect and courtesy and, you know, to the landowner, just all the things that some other person would have filled that role. But sometimes our mentors have to step up and do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I get it. The majority of my students, man, probably under 5% of my students have both parents in their home.
Yeah.
You know, and it reflects in how these kids operate, right? Like we're meant to have both parents in the home. God bless anyone that's listening to this podcast that is doing it on their own. And you know, that's not the way the system was designed for. It was designed for the masculine and the feminine to be able to join in unity and to then nurture and encourage and to, you know, tough love and, you know, a hug and a squeeze and a pat on the back and, you know, all right, you got this. Go be a courageous individual.
Yep. No, it's tough anymore out there in the world, but all we can do is what little bit we can do to help.
So you're familiar with the five stages of hunting. I'm assuming on this. I guess I should have asked. And how there's, you know, when you first become a hunter, all you want to do is notch a tag, and then you want to start, you know, chasing after different species or higher qualification or representation of a species, and then you try a different method to ultimately the fifth stage is you find more enjoyment in hunting when you watch other people or you can help other people experience it because you've had so much of that journey. With you loving hunting and wanting to give back, did you find yourself jumping towards the end, that fifth stage, that mentor stage sooner, or was that something that just naturally developed with age and experience?
I think I'm going to say sooner, partly because my own hunting journey, like I mentioned, I had to learn it on my own and it was difficult.
Yeah.
My buddy and I were like, somebody tell us what to do.
Yep.
And we made a lot of blunders on our own, you know, going out there and not doing things right. And so I have empathy when somebody says, I want to learn. I thought, I've been there. I mean, right off the bat, even though I was still experimenting with long range shooting. One, I went through that phase and did that for a year and like, okay, done it. You know, yeah. Killed an elk at 726 yards and like, okay, that was not going to do that again, but at least I did it, you know?
Yep.
And so, but always I've always had this empathy toward helping other people. I think even when I was younger, cause I was just so desperate to learn on my own. I remember that longing to have that help and couldn't find it. Yeah. Very often. And when I found somebody, I probably was a nuisance as a kid. You know, they're like, oh, are you back again?
I love it. What would you say hunting has done for you as an individual?
Wow. That's a good question. I mean, it's part of my identity, a big part of my identity of who I am. And everybody, church, everywhere I go, of course, on the side of my truck, I have a big logo, First Hunt Foundation. But, and I wear my shirt, I wear my logo all the time. I don't think I have too many shirts without a logo on my wife. And I'll be going to, and the reason I do is I want people to say, what's the First Hunt Foundation? So I can give them a brochure and tell them about it. I feel like I'm constantly marketing, trying to find people that will, you know, help us out, find us mentees, be a mentor, find us access to land. I mean, if they just see me as a regular citizen. Now, there's times I go on date night, I don't wear it. So
I was going to say, are you wearing that you date night and working all at the same time?
Just most, you know, anyway. So I don't know. I just, it's who I am. I joke about it. I should send you an article I wrote. Called The Making of a Hunter. And it jokingly talks about it being part of your DNA that you can't explain on why you want to be a hunter. Mm. It's just something inside telling you, like I said, my dad went a few times and I just wanted to go so bad. I didn't know why. I just knew that I needed to be there.
Yeah.
For some reason.
Yeah. Man, you're speaking my language because that is how So this is the Soul Seekers podcast, right?
Yeah.
We're seeking after the souls of other individuals to get them involved. And at the same time, we're seeking after our own soul out in the wild, right? Yeah. Like Hatchet or The Call of the Wild or whatever, you know, these books or movies that the youth read, and maybe not so much today. Hopefully they do. But, you know, like that type of stuff challenged my courage. As a young boy, like I would watch John Wayne movies, and my favorite movie was Shane, you know, old cowboy Western movies. And I'd look at this, and the household that I grew up in was littered with confusion, right? And I was a scared little boy. I wasn't courageous. I was scared to step out of line, get in trouble, cause issues. And that resonated in a lot of areas in my life because I was not brave or courageous to try something new, to fail. Yeah. And so I had this call, though, and I'd be like, man, like, look at these people. Look at these Western movies. Look at these people out on the range, out in the mountain, men, like self-reliance, grit, determination, courage, freedom, sovereignty. Yeah. All these traits that I admired and I wanted for myself, and yet I was too scared to take that first step and to be like, okay, this is what I want, and even to voice it. And so it took me until I was 30 years old to be like, you know what? I'm finally going to answer that call that I've always had on my heart, that I've always had on my soul, and that is to become a hunter, to become somebody who does not require support from anyone else to survive on this world. I can finally provide for myself. Because if I can't provide for myself, how can I provide for my wife? How can I provide for my children? How can I provide for my community? How can I provide for all the different people that I interact with on a daily basis? Because as a human being, my job is to continually give and bless. But if I'm too caught up in fear and that's holding me back, and what am I doing? And that was my big realization that I had, and it was a call on my soul as well. It's like I can't explain it. It's just I have to hunt. It's a part of me. It's just, it's what I do.
Yeah. It's who you are. Yeah.
It's really fascinating. You know, I love learning as much as possible and, you know, history going back to like, tribal roles, right? Like not everyone needs to be the hunter, right? You need people to also do the other things. Somehow in my DNA, I feel like I, within that tribal role, like this is just who I am.
Yep. Yep.
Do these conversations come up after people go on experiences with you and you're like, well, something awakened within me. Like I've tapped into something new that I didn't know existed, but I always felt it within myself.
We actually get a lot of that. And then I'm going to say there's also what I'm going to call the intellectual hunter. Mm-hmm. It's like it's a thought process. It's an activity. It has various steps that you have to learn, just like you have to learn something in life, a game or whatever. And they'll go through those steps and they'll be successful. And they'll go, I did that. I could do that again, but I don't see that drive. And I'm like, there's others that are like, you know, like you just change their world and you can see it. Mm-hmm. And there's others like, wow, I did that. I could do that again. And it's almost like it's not so genetic. It's an intellectual thing. I have four sons and I'd say they're all hunters, but one of them one day years ago before he got married and all that, he said, because I took him hunting, he's killed deer, elk and everything. He said, Dad, I'm just not really into hunting. I'm kind of like inside of me, I'm like, ah, you know, but I'm like, okay, just be nice. And I said, well, you know, that's cool. It's not for everybody. I said, well, I'm just trying to teach you a life skill. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to teach you something that if the world goes south, and I told him, and I think there must have been a hurricane recently on TV, as you remember the hurricane, and they showed the grocery stores, there's literally nothing. Yeah. They come and just buy everything out. Those are the people who don't know how to take care of themselves, and they just have to go buy it right then. I'm trying to teach you that if things go bad, that someday when you're married, that you will have the skills to go get food for your family without depending on the grocery stores and other things like that. Couple of days later, he came up to me and he said, hey, Dad, can we go hunting? And he wasn't doing it because he was like his brothers and me, like, I just jazz. He was looking at it kind of like, I need to know this skill. Yeah. It might come in handy to save my family and me someday.
Yep.
And that's okay. That's
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because people that at least are the intellectual hunter, as you call it, at least understand the importance of hunting and therefore yeah. They can vote and impact legislation. And, you know, that by itself makes a difference.
Yeah.
You know, that's really interesting. I worked, one of my first jobs I ever had was in a grocery store, and I worked from 15 years old all the way up until I got my first teaching job. And I that's what I did. A lot of people don't realize that grocery stores only have 3 days of food in stock. And if everyone's going to that exact same grocery store, that stuff disappears very fast.
Very fast.
Very fast. And so, to be able to provide food for yourself and others is extremely important. It's also a big part of like having community, right? Whether you live in a neighborhood or you don't live in a neighborhood, you know, have a community of resources. You have a skill set. That skill set is now an official trade. Whether you don't consider hunting a trade, it is, right? Some people are electricians. Some people are HVAC installers. Some people are plumbers. You know, teaching is kind of a trade, but it's not so much of a trade in regards to, hey, I can give you knowledge in trade for food. Feed me, please.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can, as a hunter, trade your skill set and what you can provide with that for other things in community with people. And then that's something that is like, okay, for the intellectual hunter out there, like, okay, that's actually a really good idea. I need to make sure I keep the skill honed so that I have that ability to.
Well, in our part of the world, in other states, they have salvage permits now for deer killed on the highway, and they do not stay in the ditch here more than a few hours.
Yep.
somebody picks them up. And that's not hunting, but they're using the skills from hunting of, I'm going to take that, process it, get rid of the bad, you know, meat, but yep, I'm going to keep part of it. And it's not going to waste.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually made a YouTube video on my channel about salvaging roadkill deer. And I picked up a deer in the state of Washington that was freshly killed. And I was like, dude, sweet, more meat. Like, we're good to go. Turns out down here in the state of Texas, you actually cannot pick up roadkill.
Really?
And I was very disappointed hearing that. And I talked to a game warden just about a month ago, and he was like, yeah, you know, the majority of people, they just want to cut the heads off. They just want the antlers. And I don't want to get a call, you know, just so that someone can keep a head. I'm like, yeah, I understand that. But, you know, depending on how fresh that kill is. Now, obviously, it's hot down here, right?
Yeah, like, it don't take them long to start turning.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, up in the north, it's a lot cooler. Animals don't turn as bad or as quickly. So it's very interesting. I love it. What advice would you have for somebody who is hunt curious? That they're like, hey, you know what? I'm listening to this podcast. Maybe I want to check out hunting. Maybe I've been hearing it. Beyond going to First Hunt Foundation's website and getting connected, what words of advice would you have for them?
Well, you did remind me, on our website, you can sign up as a mentee. You can go there, like, I want to learn how to hunt. And when you sign up as a mentee, it pulls up access to the mentor map, which is across the nation. And you can see real quickly if there's a mentor close to you. Our big goal is to have a mentor within 1 hour of everybody in the United States. Now, that's aggressive, but when you look at our map, you know, 10 years ago, there was one dot on it. It was me.
Yeah.
Now there's almost 1,500 dots on there scattered across 50 states. And someday I hope there's 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 dots on there of people willing to give some of their time. So the advice is to find someone. Don't do it on your own. I mean, I've met so many people, I bet you have too, that learned hunting on YouTube. Totally. Mm-hmm. I mean, they learned everything, went out, killed an animal all on their own, and they struggled through it, but it worked. I mean, they got through it. But my advice is find a real warm-blooded person out there that's willing to talk to you about hunting, and they're out there.
Yeah.
I mean, they're out there.
Yeah. YouTube University is what I call it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, figure it out.
And it's got good stuff on it.
I learned how to video edit it just because of YouTube. Like, all right, let's dive in. All right. Here's a question for you. With new hunters, I always view things as you're investing in yourself. And a lot of people are not taught that you are an investment in your own right. Right. Like, there's to spend money on yourself to further your knowledge is a big aspect. People pay thousands of dollars to go to universities and are in debt for years and decades after that for a long time to invest in themselves. When it comes to a new hunter, do you recommend somebody three options? Find a mentor, figure it out on their own, maybe YouTube University, or if they have the means, pay for a guided hunt.
Yeah, that was that's a trick question, buddy. we never use the word guided in our vernacular, because in some states, if you're providing a service, you're breaking the law. Idaho is one of them, because they have a guide commission, and if you're providing a service or taking money, then you're a guide. And so we are mentors, teachers, not guides. So when I hear the word guide, and all guides are not created equal.
Correct.
There's some guys that will take you out and be a mentor. They will teach you everything. And others are like, hey, you paid me money, and just go get an animal. And that's what you paid for. You didn't pay me to teach you how to track, how to look for sign, all the things that a mentor would teach you before you harvested. Mm-hmm. They're just out there to harvest because the client paid for it. So I'm not super big on, and it's a one and done deal. Our mentored, even our events, we 3-day events, it's not a one and done. After it's done and they've harvested, we say, okay, now let's get you hooked up to a mentor. So the next time it's not going to be a classroom setting in a farmer's field in alfalfa with doe tags, it's going to be in a rough, hard hunt. So let's get you, you know how to do it, you know the basics, but now you need some more help.
Yeah.
And so, I'm not bashing guides. I mean, sometimes I wish I could afford to go on some guided hunts or some hunts I'd love to do that.
Yep.
You know, that I might need a guide. I mean, not too long ago, 5 years ago, I did my first archery bear hunt and I had a mentor, you know, and I'm getting to be an old guy and I never hunted bear with a bow, but now I know how to hunt them. In Idaho, where you can bait them and where to put the stands, where to put the bait for the wind. I mean, there's just all these nuances. I had no idea that if I went on a guided hunt, they just stuck me in a tree, say, shoot that one, bum, then done with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And now I can teach other people how to do that.
Yep. Yep. I love that. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you feel like we need to make sure that we hit home?
Well, you know, from the foundation side, I'm going to say we have a lot of mentor perks, I call them, for signing up to be a mentor. And I don't want people signing up for the perks.
Yep.
Because I want them signing up for the stuff you and I have been talking about, that pleasure, that knowledge of teaching somebody else and passing it on and all that stuff. But on the other hand, you know, besides the liability insurance, we have a ton of organizations. Like we're a Vortex dealer, but we don't sell to the public. We only let our mentors and the new hunters take advantage of Vortex prices with no markup. And so awesome. I'm not even going to say what the discount is because it will shock you. But we sell probably more Vortex than a whole lot of mom and pop places, and we don't make a penny on it.
Yeah.
But so we try to help our mentors out, like, hey, you're volunteering your time. It's expensive. You're using your gas. You're doing it for free. Let us help get you some discounts and stuff like that that will help you. And we same with the mentees. They've identified in the National Action Plan, R3 Action Plan, that the cost of getting into hunting is a deterrent. Mm-hmm. It keeps a lot of people out. It's like, I want to hunt. They're like, oh my gosh, a gun costs $500 or a bow costs, you know, this much. And so we try to find deals to make that entry into your hunting journey not so painful.
Yeah.
And we're not making any money on it. Literally everything we do is like, nope, this is what our cost is. This is what your cost is.
You are a true nonprofit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we have no paid staff, but we still have, you know, bills. Our insurance probably is going to go up to over $20,000 or $30,000 this year. Mm. We give away $10,000 worth of first hunt hats and shirts and other, we go traveling to shows. You know, we can't expect our volunteers to buy gas to go spend in motels that work for us for 3 days at an outdoor show. So right. We have those bills, but we don't have any salary.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. I love that, man. I think the barrier to entry and how expensive hunting can be to get into is really frustrating, especially with inflation nowadays and how expensive life is just in general. Right. I used to work at REI back before I was a hunter. I have a little granola side in me.
Oh man.
And and ironically, I killed my very first big game animal was a black bear. I shot it wearing Birkenstocks. So like I really like that connection is there.
I love it.
But the whole tying it back into the REI is before I hunted, my hobbies were rock climbing, mountain biking, snowboarding, everything that REI did, that right. was what I yeah. did. And what I found is life is more enjoyable when you're doing it with somebody else, right?
Yes.
And so I'd want to go rock climbing, but then I'd be like, hey, you guys want to go rock climbing? They're like, well, what gear do I need? And so I ended up buying a lot of gear for all these different activities, just so that I could always provide something for somebody and they wouldn't have to have an excuse of, oh, well, I don't have any gear or we can't go rent it or right. all that. And it removed that barrier of entry and it made a difference on getting people involved. And that was something that I thought was really cool. When it comes to getting involved with a mentee coming or a mentor showing up, who provides what? How is that navigated in your program?
So from the mentee side?
Or the mentor. Like, I want to sign up to be a mentor, but do I then have to provide all the gear or stuff that a mentee would need?
Right. Nope, that's a good question. Yeah, right. Currently, right now, the way it stands is if you sign up as a mentor, we run you through the background check, that criminal background check, and then once you're, I guess, certified, then you're covered and you can continue to mentor. You use your own gear because we don't, you know, there's places like where we have chapters. I mentioned chapters where we start buying equipment. But if you don't have a chapter nearby, you may be using your own gun and kids won't have it. I had two kids when I first started. The first year showed up with tennis shoes and a Walmart bag. That happened twice. And literally they had a snack in their Walmart bag. And I'm looking at them like, they got nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, they got nothing.
Yeah.
And so we have to provide that. But again, once we get chapters, we have guns donated to us. We have fundraisers and we buy guns like youth shotguns and 22s and all that. But until you get chapters, everybody's kind of on their own. And people are doing that anyway. Half the people, over half, I'd probably say 80% of the mentors that sign up are already mentoring. It's like they're already doing their neighbor kids and their kids. And they say, why should I shout out with you? And I say, well, because liability insurance, here's all the other thing. The perks kind of come in handy. You got a big national organization. And if you get a chapter going, you guys can raise money and host big events, you know, and get equipment. And they're like, oh, okay. Yeah. They sign up. So, so anyway.
I love it. I love it. Brother, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks for spending some time with me, sharing your love for hunting and spreading the gospel of it because it's so awesome. Everyone needs to experience it and hear it, right?
Oh, yeah.
What's your call to action that you, elevator pitch, whatever it is that you would want to have all our listeners to leave with?
Come join us. Become part of a movement. Become part of a team. You know, it's there's something about doing it on your own, and there's something about doing it with folks that have the same mindset, you know, because we're all in this together and we'll help each other. The other thing I tell our mentors, we're all over the nation, and maybe we got somebody in Rhode Island that would like to come to Wyoming. Well, they can call the Wyoming mentor because they're a brother or sister in arms and go, hey, I'd like to come hunt out in the West. I've never hunted out West. Could you help me? And you're, oh, yeah, you're one of the tribe, you know, you're one of us. Yeah. And you've got a friend and comrades that are willing to help you. We're not selfish. I haven't met anybody yet in our mentor base that's selfish. They're all wanting to give back, even if it's to somebody else in some other area.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, sharing your love for hunting and your passion for making sure it lasts for generations to come. Everybody, First Hunt Foundation, they are saving the hunting heritage one person at a time and hopefully multiple people at a time with the more mentees and mentors that get involved. And if you want to see hunting last for generations to come, then you got to be the change. You got to take action. And everything, whether or not you want to call yourself an ambassador for hunting, the minute you became a hunter, you are an ambassador for hunting. So wherever you go, that goes with you, and it's an opportunity to have conversations, to inspire, to encourage, to educate, and to leave a lasting legacy because you can never outgive good. Brother Rick, thank you so much for coming on the show. Really appreciate it. Everybody, guys, you go check out firsthuntfoundation.org. Go check out everything that they got going on. And even if you are not signing up as a mentor, go and check out the free ABCs of Outdoor Mentorship course that Rick mentioned, because that is something that, you know, that's not going to go void in your life. You're going to pick up something from that that'll cross over to other areas in your life, whether it be your career or parenting or any of that. So, Rick, thank you so much. Everybody, if you like this episode, give it a thumbs up, like, share, subscribe, leave a rating, comment. Anything helps. Share the mission of Mentorship is Conservation. For Johnny Mack and Rick Brazell at First Hunt Foundation, be blessed, freedom on, and as always, stay soulful. If you enjoyed today's podcast and want to support the show, you can always like, share, subscribe, and leave a rating as it helps us share our mission of mentorship is conservation. Thank you so much for tuning in and being a part of Soul Seekers Nation as we transform lives through primal adventure.